The issue, of course, is whether cancer is a nuclear genetic disease or whether cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. What I did was I presented evidence from the old literature and newer experiments showing that nuclear genetic damage cannot be the origin of cancer. There are a number of experiments that were done conceptually as well as by experiment showing that if the nucleus of the tumor cell is implanted into a normal cytoplasm containing normal mitochondria, the tumorigenic phenotype is suppressed despite the continued presence of the so-called tumor-associated mutations. These observations indicate that genetic mutations are not sufficient for driving the nature of the disease. What the mutations seem to do is abort development, but do not cause tumors. The other experiment is if you transplant a normal nucleus into a cancer cytoplasm where the mitochondria are defective, you do not get normal cells, but you get either dead cells or tumor cells. What these findings indicate is that the normal nucleus cannot reprogram a cancer cytoplasm, but a normal cytoplasm can suppress any genetic abnormality associated with the origin or progression of cancer. These findings, viewed together from a broad range of independent studies, indicate that cancer is not a gene-only driven process, and that the mitochondria play a major role. An extra nuclear epigenetic system plays a role in the origin of this disease.
But could it be the case that if you have nuclear damage that impacts somehow on the mitochondria in the cell, causes them to become defective and therefore leads to cancer?
Well, the mitochondria are the first organelles that are damaged. So what happens is that the integrity, the fidelity of DNA repair and the fidelity of nuclear mitotic division is under the control of mitochondrial function through calcium currents in the cytoplasm linked to the proton motive gradient of the mitochondria. What happens in cancer progression is you get aneuploidy and nuclear gene mutations, genomic instability. At some point, the genomic instability will impede or prevent a return to normal behavior. So it facilitates progression. It's not the cause of progression, but it prevents a return to metabolic normalcy. So the accumulated mutations in broken chromosomes reach a point where a threshold is reached where the cancer cells can no longer be returned to a normal metabolism.
And that leads to cancer.
Well, you know, it's all part of the same process. You know, the inflammation in the microenvironment is part of cancer. You know, that's there because the cells are fermenting. It's an unhealed wound. The persistent inflammation leads to further genomic instability because the respiration. One of the more important issues is that this is not a Darwinian evolutionary process. It's a Lamarckian process. It's the inheritance of acquired characteristics, use and disuse. With each division, mitochondrial respiration becomes less used because of damage, and primitive glycolytic function, fermentation, increases. So this is what Lamarck said. And then there is horizontal gene transfer in the formation of metastasis, where cells of the immune system, leukocytes, macrophages, these kinds of cells, will fuse with other cells in the microenvironment to lead to hybridization and metastatic spread.
Well, this is fascinating, and I know that you spoke to me before after a previous workshop, and you had a lot of feedback from members of the public.
Well, that talk and also the book that I've written has now generated considerable interest in alternative approaches to management of the disease. Once the disease is recognized as a metabolic disease, then we can begin to entertain metabolic solutions. Many of these solutions are very cost-effective and non-toxic and quite effective in reducing or managing the disease. We don't like to use the term cure because we haven't used these therapies long enough to determine whether anyone would be cured from the disease. We do know that we can get significant regression by targeting the metabolic fuels for the cell, for the cancer cell, and transitioning normal cells to a fuel that the tumor cells can't use, which is an oxidizable ketone. You can then reduce inflammation, you can kill cancer cells by apoptosis, programmed cell death, and you can enhance the health and vitality of the surrounding tissues. So reducing of inflammation, specifically killing cancer cells without harming the microenvironment, reducing the vasculature, all of these together is a therapy that can be realized, and it's a little inconvenient because there is some food restriction, but it's not as bad as the adverse effects of the current standards of care.
And then did you go on to say that you would actually try and increase the oxygen pressure as well?
Yeah, this is very important. Cancer cells can protect themselves from reactive oxygen damage through their high level of fermentation and the use of glucose through both glycolysis and the pentose phosphate pathway. These two processes will protect cancer cells from a number of different drugs. So the high fermentation and pentose phosphate pathway are actually pathways that protect the tumor cells from a lot of different therapies. Our approach lowers the fuel for those pathways, that is basically glucose and glutamine together, will then make those cells vulnerable to a whole spectrum of non-toxic, relatively inexpensive drugs, which then can be used to manage cancer for long-term periods.
Is there any updates that you've got to tell me since we spoke last time or not?
If what I'm saying is right, then we should be able to target and destroy systemically metastatic cells. And we are seeing this in the models that show systemic metastasis in a natural syngeneic host. In other words, you should use the most natural form of the disease to test the hypothesis of how this is going to work in the human. And we're beginning to see very good response in the natural hosts to these therapies. Once you realize that this is not a genetic disease, it's a metabolic disease, then all of a sudden the whole view of the disease changes. And not only that, the therapy changes. It's just one of those things that's going to take time. It may take a whole generation or maybe two generations, but eventually I think our species is smart enough to recognize at some point that this is the way it is. I hope that. Otherwise, there's no major advances.
What have you got out of this meeting?
Well, I think that the issue here is that it's good to have a broad range of individuals present information on diverse topics, and then it begins to allow me to more clearly solidify what I know about the origin of cancer. And I also know how controversial and muddled some of the areas of cancer can be, leading to significant confusion on many aspects. It's a disease that has created a great deal of controversy in many different areas, and it's troubling that we are unable to pursue those particular approaches that may have the greatest benefit and impact because of restrictions by the field on the nature of the design of experiments. You know, why in cancer are we pursuing the same kinds of therapies over and over again with no significant impact on patient health? The numbers of people dying per day for cancer has not changed in more than 15 years. And the incidence of cancer is increasing at the same rate as the NCI cancer budget. The more money the NCI spends, the more cancer cases we get. It's just a correlation. There's no causality here. But isn't it interesting that the more we spend on cancer, the more cancer we get and the more people are dying? It's really difficult, and I'm wondering at what point, how many more years will we need to examine these figures before someone says we need to do something different than what's currently being done?